I'm going to invite you to close your eyes and take in these words. Awaken. Good morning, beautiful, for you are beautiful. Awaken, I say to you. Awaken to the miracle of your being. Awaken to the miracle of who you are. Awaken to God's everlasting love within you. Awaken to the gift of your life. Awaken to the miracle of all life. Awaken to the grace of God. Awaken that within you that is wanting to be awakened. Awaken to your strength. Awaken to your authentic power. Awaken to your joy. Awaken to your golden and open heart. Awaken, my friend, my beautiful friend, awaken. My topic this morning is about listening. And what I just read to you came through me, I will say, as I was preparing for one of our council ring meetings. It was my role the next morning to do morning meditation, and I wasn't sure what I was going to do, so I just went into prayer, and these words came to me, just as they are, and that's what I shared in morning meditation. And I don't believe it was me that wrote these. I merely listened to God's voice, and this is what came to me. I mentioned yesterday that in preparing for these talks, I asked God for guidance on what I should talk about. And these messages, I guess, came to me at different times. And I also mentioned earlier in my talks that my spiritual journey has been a quest to have a direct personal relationship with God, and that my path has led me to explore different religions, coming back ultimately to my Christian roots. I have sought to find the essence of Jesus' message for us and to try as best I can to live authentically and to open myself to guidance in answer to prayers and questions. I mentioned Glenn Clark's statement in The Bond of Faith that in our attempts to get close to Christ, some take the door of mysticism and some of sacrament, some the gateway of metaphysics, and some social service. It appears my door is often the door of what is called mysticism. One morning in my meditation, the words, "just listen," came to me. As I thought about that, I was struck by how wise and how powerful a statement that is. I've come to realize in preparing this talk that just listening is how we create connections, both to ourselves, to others, and to the divine, by just listening. I heard a joke, actually this morning, from someone who knew my topic would be about listening, so I'm going to share it with you. So, why did the chicken cross the road? Why did the chicken cross the road? He crossed the road to come to your house. Knock, knock. The chicken, I just told you that, weren't you listening? All right, so when someone's talking to you, do you just listen? I know there are many times for me that as a person is talking, I'm already thinking about what I'm going to say or how I'm going to respond. And this has happened so many times, more than I was aware of, but it's been pointed out to me, for example, in negotiations that I do for my work, that my listening has a defend-attack approach, or used to anyway. And the union that I negotiated with or against, as the case may be, for about 18 years, the teachers' union. They had a system early on when I first started working for a large school district as their labor relations and general counsel person. Secretly, I didn't find out about this until later, they had characterized everyone on our team as different animals. And each of their team was assigned to watch a particular person on our team and then analyze what animal category that person fell into. And so I asked the executive director of the teachers union, well, what animal was I? And he said, well, you were a cat. I said, well, what does that mean? And he said, it meant that if we wanted to get agreement, we couldn't back you into a corner. If we wanted to get an agreement, we had to come at it sideways. But if we wanted great quotes for our propaganda newsletters to our teachers about how awful the district was, we could back you into the corner, and you'd come out with your claws bared, and we'd get some great quotes. Kind of devious, but it was feedback for me that I had a defend attack. When the union started saying these things about my client, about administrators, about how awful they were, my mind went was, I have to defend my client, and I would come out claws bared and swinging. And there were times with my personal friends as well. I have one friend that lives in Southern California, and so we communicate primarily by phone. And one evening, we were on one of our phone conversations, and she said, I'd like to share something with you, and I have a request of you. And I said, all right. And she said, this isn't easy for me to say, and those words are never comforting. But she said, when I'm talking, I get the sense that you're just thinking about yourself, and then instead of responding to what I'm saying, you start talking about yourself. So I'd like to request that in our conversations, you give me a chance to speak and just listen to me. And then I'll give you a chance to speak and I'll just listen to you. And so that's how now our conversations are structured. And it was really good feedback for me. And, you know, it was hard to hear because we don't like to hear those kind of things about ourselves. But I found how often I did that. Once it became part of my awareness, I realized how often I did that in how many circumstances. So I've been working on just listening. Sometimes when I'm talking to people, I can see their mind wandering as well. And it's like you want to look at them and say, just listen to me. Just hear what I'm saying. A little while ago, I was at lunch with a group of women friends. They're all retired administrators from the school district I worked in, and we get together for lunch once a month. And I had just come back from a trip to the Balkans, the countries of Romania, Bulgaria, Macedonia, and Albania. And someone said, well, Diana, how was your trip? And I said, oh, it was great. And I started to tell them about my trip. And almost immediately, a couple of the other women started a side conversation. And the people I was talking to, their minds were kind of wandering. And then they started a side conversation. And after about a minute, I stopped and thought, nobody wants to hear about my trip. And I was kind of insulted and hurt that they didn't want to hear me because, you know, I've spent many a lunch listening to their stories about dealing with aging parents or their grandkids or their trips or their service projects they're working on. And I thought, you know, when in my life do I not listen? And it was a gift to me to have that present for me and how I felt about that and realize what a gift it is to really listen and to really hear someone. This is a problem with not following my script here. I had a friend a long time ago who shared that he and his wife were having some disagreements. And in a counseling session, she said that, you know, one of the places where I'm really annoyed with you is that when I come home from work and start sharing about my day, complaining about my boss or my staff or whatever, you jump in and you try and fix it or solve it. And it makes me feel that you aren't that interested in what I'm saying. I just want you to listen and hear what I'm saying and not try to fix it or solve it. My friend, who's a male, said, well, I thought I was being helpful. I thought that when you were sharing all these problems, you were looking for some advice and some solutions. And so I just thought I was being helpful. And she said, no, I just want you to hear what I'm saying. I'm just venting. I don't want you to try and fix it. I want you to just hear it and commiserate with me. And he said, well, now that he knew that that's what she wanted from him, he said, well, that'll be easy. Now I don't have to sit and try and remember all the details you're telling me. So in case I'm called upon to have to sort those out and work them into a solution. So, yeah, I can just listen. I didn't know that's what you wanted from me. I'm happy to do that. And so they worked out an arrangement, a deal, where she could say, okay, I'm going to share with you about my day, and I just want you to listen. And he goes, great, I can do that. Or she would say, okay, I'm going to need some advice at the end of my sharing with you. And he'd say, okay. So he had to listen differently because he had to store up all these little facts in case it was part of the solution. And it worked the other way as well. There's also the listening to God or spirit or divine or intuition, whatever you choose to call it. If we pray and we ask for guidance, how do we listen to God's response to us? Or do we even think there will be a response? Do we actually expect an answer when we pray? I think it can come to us in a number of ways. I know it does for me. Maybe it comes directly in meditation. Maybe it's the voice in your head that's giving you feedback. Maybe it's in a mystical experience. Maybe it's indirectly through something or someone tells us or through something that happens or doesn't happen. Maybe it's through your minister at church or a dear friend who gives you some point of wisdom that ends up being an answer to your prayer. I think it's so important that we listen in any variety of ways to how God answers us. I read an article on Facebook that was called The Tap on the Shoulder. So I loved that we sang that someone's touching you, because it works right into this story, another little synchronicity. The author tells about an encounter he had at lunch one time in a restaurant where he was sitting with a friend having lunch, and he noticed that this elderly woman came in and sat at a table that was a large table for a group of people. She was nicely dressed, and she seemed to be waiting for someone, and eventually a group came in that appeared to be her family. But as he was looking at her, he felt this energetic tap on his shoulder. And he heard in his mind, tell her she's pretty. He thought this was pretty strange because he didn't know her and he wasn't in the habit of telling complete strangers they were pretty. And in this day, he wasn't sure that was safe. But eventually, as he finished his lunch and he started to leave, he got that tap on the shoulder again, tell her she's pretty. So he thought, okay, and he went over to her and he got down at her eye level and he said, just in case no one has told you this today, you look lovely. The woman was startled, but she looked at him with a beautiful smile on her face, and she got tears in her eyes and said, thank you. You have no idea what that means to me. My husband died a year ago, and that's the kind of thing he would have told me. With that, the man asked if he could give her a hug, and with tears glistening in both their eyes, she said, that would be most wonderful. The two hugged, and he left, feeling blessed and happy that he listened to his tap on the shoulder, knowing they were both in a happier place for his having imparted this message to her. The gift we get when we listen and get those taps on the shoulder and then answer them. I had my own experience of a tap on the shoulder one day when I was riding home from work on the bus. It was a very rainy day, stormy, rainy day, and as I got on and sat down, I noticed an elderly man who got on after me who was frantically searching for something. And as the bus moved on, I debated whether to say anything to him, and after all, what could I do? But an inner voice told me to ask him if he needed help. So I moved near him and asked if he had lost something. And he said, yes, I did. I must have dropped my glove when I got on the bus. It's my favorite gloves. I've had them a long time. They're made out of this wonderful kid leather. And now I only have one, and I must have dropped the other one. And I'm just so upset that I lost it. On an impulse, I said, well, give me your phone number, and when I get home, I'll drive back to the bus stop and see if I can find it. So he did, thanking me profusely. I got home, got in my car, started driving back to the bus stop, and just about a block from my house, here was the old man slowly walking across the street on his way home. So I pulled over and asked him if he wanted to join me in looking for his glove, and he got in and we set off. And as I drove, he told me about his life, about what he had done for a living, about his wife who had dementia now. And we arrived at the bus stop, and I pulled over into the bus zone. I got out, and against all odds, we found his glove. He was beside himself with joy, and I was so glad I had listened to that voice that told me to talk to him. As an added bonus, he came back downtown a few weeks later and asked me to go to lunch with him to thank me for finding his glove. And we had a delightful conversation, and I learned all about his life and what he had done, and just this wonderful, delightful person. And then it turned out that he happened to be a neighbor to a woman who worked for one of our largest clients at the time. And he had told her all about the kindness I had showed him. So she made a point to call me and thank me because she adored this man and said what joy I brought to his life. And then she called my boss and said, you've got this really great person working for you. And so who would have ever guessed that all that good would flow from listening to that voice? So how does God or Spirit talk to you? How do your angels get your attention? For me, it's sometimes this bell I've mentioned, the little, you know, like hotel desk bell that says, pay attention here. I may be pondering a decision or have a question I'm seeking an answer to, and seemingly out of nowhere and out of context, voices emerge from the background, or some headline or ad will catch my eye, or there's some synchronicity that you go, you could brush off as, oh, that's just a coincidence, or you could say, that's my message. And when I take time to pray and to listen for God's answer, sometimes I get a response right away, but sometimes it's on the long loop. As I was preparing this talk, I was reminded of Glenn Clark's words in The Divine Plan. In The Divine Plan, Glenn writes, "When I am hindered from doing that thing that I want to do, I believe that God has closed the door only to open another, and that upon every closed door, there is a sign pointing to a better and larger door just ahead. My disappointments, therefore, are his appointments." Now, I've shared with you that I couldn't find a teaching job, and so I decided to go to law school. And during the year it took me to prepare for and take the law school admissions test and then apply for law school and wait to hear back, I got a job working as a substitute teacher in special education. I mentioned I got an elementary teaching credential, and I had worked as an instructional aide in special education, and so I knew some of the teachers, and one of the teachers I had worked with had become a program specialist, and they started calling me to be a substitute. At one point, she called me and she said, "We've got a situation and we need some help, and I'm going to ask you if you would consider taking a job for this whole second semester as a substitute teacher for the high school aphasia class." That's a severe language disorder program, and I had been an instructional aide in that program. Now, I had never taught high school. I had no background in high school. I had no training in speech therapy, and this was a whole semester. But I met the other teacher I'd be team teaching with, and I said yes. And so I started teaching at San Gabriel High School. Now, there were only two high school classes in the entire Los Angeles County, and so the students were bused from all over the county. And just to give you a comparison of the size of LA County, if you took Delaware and Rhode Island and put them together area-wise, it would not be as large as LA County. So it was a huge county, and kids were bused from all over. And it was a brand new high school program. They hadn't had a high school program for aphasia kids, so there was no curriculum, there were no materials, so we had to make it up as we went. And as it turned out, it was a perfect match. She was a speech therapist with no teacher training. I had teacher training at the elementary level with no speech therapy background, and the kids all performed academically at an elementary level. So we were able to write our own curriculum. I was able to give reading assessment tests to the kids to see where they were in terms of their reading capability, and we made up our own lesson plans. And coincidentally, at the same time, it was a time when the collective bargaining statute for teachers had just gone into effect, and the teachers were organizing into unions to start doing this new collective bargaining, and they were doing this at the high school that I was working at, and I started thinking about maybe there's an intersection of law and education. Maybe I can find a way to take my interest in education and move it into the legal field. And so when I went to law school, I looked for the classes that would support that. There was a school law class, there were labor relations classes, and I took all those classes. Now, the school law class was taught by an attorney who was a school attorney. He wasn't a full-time professor. That was the only class he taught. And I knew the person who was a law clerk for that law firm that was doing school law, and she was a year ahead of me in law school. So I knew, this was my second year, I knew she was in her last year, and she was going to have to quit to take the bar exam. So I hit him up for a job after the first class. I said, I want her job when she has to quit. And so they interviewed me, and I got that job, and I ended up working my whole last year in a school law firm. And so I became a school attorney, and that experience as a clerk opened the door for me to work in a labor relations firm that also did school law. And eventually I got another job. I moved back to Sacramento, got another job back with that same firm, which had since split up. And then after about 5 years in private practice, I got a phone call from a person I knew from law school who said, you know, the Public Employment Relations Board, which is the agency that oversees all of the collective bargaining statute, the governor just appointed a new board member and he needs a legal advisor. Would you be interested in that job? And I was, and I applied, and I got that job, and so I started being a legal advisor. And it was a door that I hadn't pursued. It was a door that just opened for me. And after a couple of years in that job, a friend of mine who was the general counsel at this large school district called and said, I'm moving on. I'd like you to apply for my job. So I applied for that job and got it, and I spent the next 20 years working for a large suburban school district as their general counsel, and then ultimately, the last 2 years, they appointed me to be head of human resources. And that was significant because I was, at that point, starting to learn about trying to combine my spiritual path with my profession. I went through a period somewhere in the middle of my career where I wasn't sure being a lawyer was really the right path for me. It didn't feel very spiritual. There was the one part of me that's pursuing spiritual growth and trying to move deeper in my relationship with God, and the other part who is an attorney, which is very worldly, very much of the world. So one time, I went down to visit a friend in Los Angeles, and she said, I want to go to this church that was started by Paramahansa Yogananda that's here in Los Angeles. So I went with her, and in this course of the service, there was a meditation, and I was mulling this question of, God, show me some sign. Am I on my right path? Is this what I'm supposed to be doing with my life? And in the meditation, I heard a voice very clearly and distinctly in my mind that said, do not concern yourself with what you're doing for a living. God needs spiritual people in every walk of life. Your spirituality and your career do not have to be at odds with each other. And I was so startled by this, I looked up, and the person who was I don't know what they called him, but the leader was looking directly at me, and I just looked at him with a startled look, and he just kind of smiled and gave a little nod, like it was his voice I was hearing. It was a very amazing experience. But then I resolved to try and figure out how I could bring those together. And I decided that being an attorney didn't mean I couldn't also be compassionate. So when I worked with teacher dismissals of teachers maybe who had mental disorders and they just really needed to be moved on out of the teaching profession, I tried to really put myself in their position of the fear they were facing as their mental capacity started diminishing, but knowing they needed to move on. And so I tried to work more from my heart as an attorney and tried to meld those two. One of the times later in my career, after I left the school district, I went back into private practice, and I got a call one day from a colleague from Southern California who I'd met through the school attorney group, and he said, "I've given your name to one of my former clients who's now a community college president up in the north part of the state, and I told him you'd be a good negotiator for him." And so he called me, the president of the college, and he said, "I want you to come do our negotiations. I hear you can be really tough and hard, and that's what I want." He said, "We've been doing this interest-based bargaining, and I think it's a waste of time, and I don't want to do that anymore." And I thought, well, here's a dilemma, because I had spent the previous, 10 years learning how to do interest-based bargaining and had really worked out a good relationship with the teachers' union in San Juan and really developed my skills in a much more peaceful, mostly, way of negotiating. We'd even gone to the Harvard School of Negotiations and done a 3-day workshop with William Urey, who was the co-author of the book Getting to Yes. William Urey and Robert Fisher kind of pioneered the whole area of interest-based bargaining, and they actually were called in to negotiate the Camp David peace accord between Israel and Palestine using this method of interest-based bargaining. And so we had incorporated that very heavily into our school district in San Juan. So when this potential client called and said he wanted me to do aggressive, hard-nosed bargaining, I had this personal dilemma, because you don't turn down a client when you're working in private practice, but it was going to really conflict with who I had come to be and see myself. But I said yes, and the first bargaining session didn't go well. The union demanded to know, why aren't we doing interest-based anymore, and what's with that? And they were angry, and I just had to say, well, the client doesn't want to do that anymore, but we can move on and keep negotiating. Well, it didn't go well. It was very contentious negotiations. And after about 3 or 4 sessions, we'd gotten nowhere, and there was a lot of animosity, a lot of anger by the faculty. And finally, one morning, I was sitting in my hotel room, getting ready to go into battle again. Felt like a gladiator heading for the ring. But I prayed to God, show me the way. What am I supposed to do in these negotiations? Give me some guidance here. So I went to negotiations, and we always started going around the table, checking in, what's happening with you, what are you doing, what's up. And I could tell their spokesperson, who was a math professor, was angry, and he sat across the table from me and was just waiting for his turn. And when his turn came to check in, he said, "Well, I'm pissed. That's how I am." He said, "I just spent 3 weeks writing my sabbatical proposal. I'm due for a sabbatical. It's in our contract. I took time away from my family. I took time away from my kids to work on the sabbatical proposal. And I really wanted this. I think it's going to help improve my instruction. And I took it to the board last night. And so did 4 other professors. And the board, without any discussion, just voted it down. No explanation, nothing. All that work was wasted, and I'm just really pissed." And while he was unloading and venting, the words came to me, "Just listen, just listen." And so when he finished, instead of trying to defend my client, which was my old model, I simply acknowledged his feelings. I said, "You know, it's clear to me you put a lot of time and effort into your proposal and sacrificed time with your family and your exercise program. And you clearly feel very passionate about what you had proposed, and I can understand why you're so angry. I don't know why the board rejected it, and I don't blame you for being angry. I'm sorry." And with that, he calmed down and he said, thank you. Thank you for hearing me. And our relationship improved 180% or 180 degrees from that moment. He was friendly. He would say hi to me when we passed in the hallway instead of shooting anger daggers through his eyes at me. We still don't reach agreement, but we had a better relationship because I had just listened. Listening is a gift we give. My book group from church, we have a church book group that recently read a book called The Surrender Experiment by Michael Singer. And Singer made a decision early in his adult life to completely surrender to whatever came into his path. He decided at one point that spirit or the divine or whatever he chose to call it had a much better idea of what his life should be than he did. So his job was just to say yes. And there were many situations he recounted in his books of time when his mind was telling him no, 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 but he had made this commitment and he said yes instead. And what unfolded for him was the most incredible life, far beyond what he ever could have imagined. And there came a point at one time where everything seemed to become crashing down. He was under investigation by the FBI, and He couldn't do all his businesses. He had developed this major medical software program, made a bunch of money, turned it into a meditation retreat center, all these things. And so in this time when he couldn't do his job anymore, he wrote a book that was called, The Untethered Soul. Well, Oprah got hold of this book, The Untethered Soul, and it became an Oprah Book Club selection. And if you know anything about that, it was an instant bestseller. And he sold countless copies of this Untethered Soul book. And so it's an interesting journey of this man who completely surrendered to life. And I don't know that I would have the courage to do that, but I thought it was very interesting. Another book my book group read that I found great meaning in is called Into the Magic Shop. It's written by James Doty, who's a medical doctor. He's a neurosurgeon, and it's his life story. And he grew up in Bakersfield, California, which is tends to be a very blue-collar kind of community, a lot of poverty, and he lived a very poor life. His father was alcoholic. Wasn't reliable for providing income for rent. He had several times when the family was thrown out on the street because they were being evicted. And then one day when he was about 12, he liked to do magic tricks, but he lost one of his props. And so he rode his bike across town to this place called the Magic Shop. And he met a woman there, and she asked him, "Do you want to do real magic?" And he said, "Yeah." And she said, "Well, then here's what you have to do. You have to promise me you will come once a week, every week, for the next 12 weeks, and then practice in between." So he committed to doing that. And she taught him about how to tap into the power of intention, how to open his heart, clear his mind, set an intention, and release it into the universe. And he practiced and he practiced and he practiced. And then one day, they were about to be evicted. And so he thought, "I don't want to be out in the street with all our belongings. It's so embarrassing and it's so humiliating." So he set his intention that something would happen to stop that eviction. And within a day or two, there was a knock on the door and he answered it. And a man asked if this was the household of his father, and he said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, you know, about 10 years ago, your father did some work for me, and I never paid him, and I want to pay him." And he handed him a check that was enough money to pay the next 3 months' rent. And this kid said, "Wow, this works." And so then he set his intention. She said, "What do you want as your intention for life?" And he said, "I want to be a doctor. I want to have a BMW. I want to have a fancy watch. I want all of these things." And she said, "Well, then that's what you work on. But you must remember this process. And you must remember to come back to your center." So he started doing this process, and then against all odds, he got into medical school because he really wasn't a very good student. He got into college, he got into medical school, he got the job of his dreams, he got the fancy car, he got the watch, he had the life, and he felt empty inside because he had lost touch with his soul. And then he remembered his lessons from this woman in the magic shop, and he came back to that, and he wrote this book as a result. So listening is so powerful. We heard in meditation this morning that we won't have peace until the power of love overtakes the love of power. And I loved what Amber said about a conversation between Einstein, Glenn Clark, and was it Jimi Hendrix? And she would pay to hear that conversation, and I think I would too. There's so many sources of wisdom. If we open to it, we open our hearts, we open our minds, and it's through listening that we make true connections with each other and with ourselves and with the divine. Listening is connecting. Listening is building community. Listening is building peace. Thank you for listening to me.